This morning he held down the fort with the aid of one enlisted man, a Hawaiian who understood little English and nothing about the teletype. Due to various delays in decoding, paraphrasing, and typing, it was 7:12 by the time Commander Kaminsky received the Ward's 6:53 message about sinking the submarine. First he tried to phone Admiral Block's aide but couldn't reach him. Then he put in a call to the Admiral's Chief of Staff, Captain John B. Earle. The phone woke up Mrs. Earle, and she immediately put her husband on the wire. To Kaminsky, the captain sounded astonished and incredulous. Captain Earle later recalled that he first felt it was just one more of the sub-sightings that had been turning up in recent months. On the other hand, this did seem too serious to be brushed off. It was the first time he heard of a Navy ship firing depth charges or anything else at one of these contacts. So he told Kaminsky to get the dispatch verified, also to notify the SyncPAC duty officer and Commander Charles Momsen, the 14th Naval District Operations Officer. Earle said he would take care of telling Admiral Block. The Admiral was on the phone by 7:15. Captain Earle relayed the news, and the two men spent the next 5 or 10 minutes trying to decide whether it was reliable or not. In the course of passing from mouth to mouth, the message had lost the point Outerbridge tried to make by saying he fired on the sub, hence must have seen it. Now neither Block nor Earle could tell whether this was just a sound contact or whether the Ward had actually seen something. Finally, they made up their minds. Since they had asked the Ward to verify, since Commander Momsen was investigating, and since they had referred the matter to SyncPAC, they decided, using Captain Earle's phrase, to await further developments. Meanwhile, Kaminsky had notified SyncPAC headquarters over at the sub-base. The assistant duty officer, Lieutenant Commander Francis Black, estimated that he got the call around 7:20. He relayed the report to the duty officer, Commander Vincent Murphy, who was dressing in his quarters on the spot. Murphy asked, did he say what he was doing about it? Did he say whether Admiral Block knew about it or not? Nothing had been said on these points, so Murphy told Black to call back and find out. He dialed and dialed, but the line was always busy. By now, Murphy was dressed and told Black, all right, you go to the office and start breaking out the charts and positions of the various ships. I'll dial one more time, and then I'll be over. The line was still busy, so Murphy told the operator to break in and have Kaminsky call the SyncPAC office. Then he ran on down to get there in time for the call. Small wonder Kaminsky's line was busy. After talking to Black, he had to phone Commander Momsen, the district operations officer. Then Momsen said to call Ensign Joseph Logan. Then a call to the Coast Guard about that sampan the Ward caught. Then Momsen on the line again at 7:25, have the ready-duty destroyer Monaghan contact the Ward. Then a call to Lieutenant Otley to get the Honolulu Harbor gate closed. Phone call by phone call, the minutes slipped away. Commander Murphy dashed into his office a little after 7:30 to find the phone ringing, but it wasn't the call that he expected from Kaminsky. It was a call from Commander Logan Ramsey, the operations officer at Patrol Wing, or Pat Wing 2, the Ford Island headquarters for all Navy patrol plane work. Ramsey was bursting with news. A PBY reported it had just sunk a sub about a mile off the Pearl Harbor entrance. Murphy told him he already had a similar report, and for the next minute or so the two men compared notes. The PBY message had been sent by Ensign Tanner. It was logged in at 7 o'clock, but there had been the usual delays in decoding, then the usual incredulity. Commander Neffler McGinnis, who was Tanner's commanding officer and in charge of Pat Wing 1 at Kaneohe, felt it must be a case of mistaken identity. He checked to make sure that all information on U.S. subs was in the hands of the patrol planes. Ramsey himself received the message around 7:30 from the Pat Wing 2 duty officer, and his first reaction was that some kind of drill message must have gotten out by mistake. He ordered the duty officer to request authentication of the message immediately. But to be on the safe side, he decided to draw up a search plan and notify SyncPAC. This was what he was doing now. As Murphy hung up, the phone began ringing again. This time it was Kaminsky, finally on the wire. He assured Murphy that Block had been told, that the ready-duty destroyer was on its way to help, that the standby destroyer had been ordered to get up steam. Murphy asked, "Have you any previous details or any more details about this attack?" "The message came out of a clear sky," Kaminsky replied. Murphy decided he'd better call Admiral Kimmel, and by 7:40 SyncPAC himself was on the telephone. The Admiral, who had left Mrs. Kimmel on the mainland as a defensive measure against any diverting influences, lived alone in a bare new house at Makalapa, about 5 minutes' drive away. As soon as he heard the news, he told Murphy, "I'll be right down." Next, Ramsey phoned again, asking if there was anything new. Murphy said there wasn't, but warned him to keep search planes available in case the Admiral wanted them. Now Kaminsky was back on the wire, reporting the Ward's run-in with the sampan. He had already told Earl, and the captain regarded it as evidence that nothing was really the matter. If there was a submarine around, what was the Ward doing escorting a mere sampan to Honolulu? He apparently didn't realize that the submarine incident was at 6:45, and the Ward had considered it definitely sunk. Commander Murphy thought the sampan report was sufficiently interesting to relay to Admiral Kimmel, and he put in another call about 7:50. Out in the harbor, Lieutenant Commander Bill Burford made the best of things as skipper of the ready-duty destroyer Monaghan. She was due to be relieved at 8 o'clock, and Burford had planned to go ashore. In fact, the gig was already alongside. Then at 7:51, a message suddenly came in from 14th Naval District Headquarters to get underway immediately and contact Ward in Defensive Sea Area. The message didn't even say what he should prepare for, but obviously it might be a couple of hours before he would be free again to go ashore. Whatever was in store for the Monaghan, the other ships in Pearl Harbor had only morning colors to worry about. This ceremony was always the same. At 7:55, the signal tower on top of the Navy Yard water tank hoisted the blue prep flag, and every ship in the harbor followed suit. On each ship, a man took his place at the bow with the jack, another at the stern with the American flag. Then, promptly at 8, the prep flag came down, and the other two went up. On the smaller ships, a bosun piped his whistle. On the larger, a bugler sounded colors. On the largest, a band might even play the national anthem. As the clock ticked toward 7:55, all over the harbor, men went to their stations. On the bridge of the old repair ship Vestal, signalman Adolf Zlabas got ready to hoist the prep flag. On the fantail of the sleek cruiser Helena at 10:10 dock, Ensign W.W. Jones marched to the flagstaff with a 4-man Marine honor guard. On the big battleship Nevada, the ship's band assembled for a ceremony that would have all the trimmings. The only trouble was the officer of the deck, Ensign Tausig, had never stood watch for morning colors before and didn't know what size American flag to fly. He quietly sent an enlisted man forward to ask the Arizona people what they were going to do. While everybody waited around, some of the bandsmen noticed specks in the sky far to the southwest. Planes were approaching, and from more than one direction. Ensign Donald L. Korn, officer of the deck on the Raleigh, noticed a thin line winging in from the northwest. Seaman Red Pressler of the Arizona saw a string approaching from the mountains to the east. On the destroyer Helm, Quartermaster Frank Handler noticed another group coming in low from the south. The Helm, the only ship underway in all of Pearl Harbor, was in the main channel, about to turn up West Lock. The planes passed only 100 yards away, flying directly up the channel from the harbor entrance. One of the pilots gave a casual wave, and Quartermaster Handler cheerfully waved back. He noticed that, unlike most American planes, these had fixed landing gear. As the planes roared nearer, pharmacist's mate William Lynch heard a California shipmate call out, "The Russians must have a carrier visiting us. Here come some planes with the red ball showing clearly." Signalman Charles Flood on the Helena picked up a pair of binoculars and gave the planes a hard look. They were approaching in a highly unusual manner, but all the same there was something familiar about them. Then he recalled the time he was in Shanghai in 1932, when the Japanese Army and Navy invaded the city. He remembered their bombing technique, a form of glide bombing. The planes over Ford Island were diving in the same way. In they hurtled, Lieutenant Commander Takahashi's 27 dive bombers plunging toward Ford Island and Hickam. Lieutenant Commander Murata's 40 torpedo planes swinging into position for their run at the big ships. Commander Fuchida marked time off Barber's Point with the horizontal bombers, watching his men go in. They were all attacking together instead of in stages as originally planned, but it would apparently make no difference. The ships were sitting ducks. A few minutes earlier, at 7:49 a.m., Fuchida had radioed the signal to attack. Tow, 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 tow. Now he was so sure of victory that at 7:53, even before the first bomb fell, he signaled the carriers that the surprise attack was successful. Tora, tora, tora. Back on the Akagi, Admiral Kusaka turned to Admiral Nagumo. Not a word passed between them, just a long, firm handshake.